Say, you mean to tell me the Navy's sitting you down here in one of those jets just so you could go fishing?
That's about it.
Hiroshima.
Well, hello, jellyheads, and welcome to another exciting hip rick 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 roaring episode of Know Your Turns at the Drive-In.
I'm Fiddlefur McDuffin.
I'm gonna let you own that voice, Lucas, because I can't. That was hard.
You got any problem with doing that, boys?
I'm Dave.
And I'm Luke.
And tonight, we're here to do our 10th episode in the series of science fiction films that we've been covering. Classic science fiction films.
Oh, so classic.
We've decided at this point that we're sticking to the 1950s for this. Pretty much right up until the end, I'm excusing one 1960 film. And we're going to cover that last. It's going to be the cap on this. But I feel it fits so much more closely in with the 1950s films than it does with the 1960s films that I it was practically the reason I wanted to do this at all. It was like, I got to get to covering that
right
on the show. So I went the long way about it and put 30 films in front of that.
30?
Yeah, I think we got something like 30 films.
Jeez,
that when we looked at.
In?
Yeah, we're 10 into like a 30 film series that we're doing.
Wow. It's a long one.
Yeah, and tonight, our 10th film in the series that we're covering is It Came From Beneath the Sea.
A tidal wave of terror engulfs the screen as a raging monster from the dawn of creation attacks the world of man.
Here, gentlemen, is your villain.
Take an enormous number of those to disable a Navy submarine.
Or just one of enormous size, Mr. Chase.
I see they picked an atom sub to go out and fight this thing. Why is that, Commander?
Could be because of the new electronic equipment or her speed.
Was she ordered back here from Hawaii just for that?
That's right. Think it's as bad as that, do you? I think we're lucky she's here.
The H-bomb blasted it loose from the depths of the Pacific. But not even the H-bomb can kill it.
Unknown object coming this way. Entering minefield. Stand by, number 38, mine.
Fire.
Go up. Ready, number 12, south.
Fire.
Coming on through.
That's the end of our first line of defense, Miss Joyce.
Then the red alert.
West Coast reels under Holocaust as the men and weapons of the atomic age battle to the death against the ageless monster of the deep.
Lucas.
Yeah.
It's been pointed out to me that some people find it helpful when we describe the plot of a film before we get going, so they know sort of what the film's about, so they follow along on our discussions, as opposed to us just jumping in and saying random stuff from this point or that point in the film, but to actually describe, you know, basically what happened in this film. So, Lucas, what is the plot of It Came From Beneath the Sea?
Octopus. Military. Misogyny.
That in that order?
In no particular order.
In no particular order. Octopus, military, and misogyny. There's surprisingly much more military and misogyny than octopus, considering that the whole point of sitting down to watch this movie is to see the giant octopus. And boy, boy, do they take the long road around to getting to show you that octopus. And then they got a submarine and they, well, the octopus does a bit of damage. It crawls up on the Golden Gate Bridge and tears that down, and then it crawls into the city and
squishes
like,
some people.
Yeah, but what bothered you about that wasn't the squishing, it's that it squishes and drags.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, you know, you step on a bug, it might not die. Once you drag it on the concrete.
And the idea of doing that to humans?
Ugh.
Just bothered you? Just like, it's like, okay, this thing's squishy, but it's a very squishy thing, so maybe we're still alive. Maybe if it just picks up its tentacle in the next minute, we'll be fine. And like, oh, God!
Exactly. You know, why do you even question it if you know what I'm talking about?
Ugh. That was an interesting choice that they made. I'm always fascinated by, like, when I get the premise and I'm seeing a movie where it's going along in the basic premise and there's nothing that surprises me, and then there's a moment where somebody does something where I'm just like, huh, that's different. I would not think of that. And that was a moment like that for me.
You know what this octopus never did?
What?
Grab a single person.
It never, yeah, it never, like, picked up anybody. Like, its tentacles were very fat. Like, it didn't have, like, skinny tentacles that could just wrap around somebody and lift them up in the air. It's like the tentacles basically just unrolled and then rolled back up.
What requires an animal like that to get that big? What is down there that it needs to be that huge? Does it feed on, like, blue whales?
The movie actually gives no explanation for why the monster is. It's not an atomic monster like we usually get. It's just there's a giant octopus and there's no rhyme or reason why it suddenly surfaced. And I think that's one of the problems of the film is that there's no drama to the setup at all. It's just, oh, we ran into a giant octopus. Oh, the giant octopus is attacking San Francisco. Oh, we've blown up the giant octopus now.
I'm surprised that, like, all it took was just fire.
Yeah.
They didn't try. Did they not try and shoot at it?
They shot at it. Bullets didn't. It was so big that bullets didn't really do that much damage.
Yeah.
Flamethrowers burned it, but ultimately they blew it up with a bomb.
But, like, why didn't, like a Navy ship roll up on it on the Golden Gate and just pop at it?
That probably would have worked. They kept saying it's important that they destroy the brain because they're like, oh, if it's, we just get a tentacle, it'll crawl off and we'll never find it again. And I'm just like, well, so what?
It didn't bother anybody before then. If it pops up, then I guess just take care of it then. I don't know.
I couldn't follow the plot. Could you?
No.
At no point did I understand at all what the main characters were doing. I just understood that they were being extremely sexist.
It's like they cut the film in the order of, like, not what it's supposed to be in, like, the script, but what they shot. So it's like you just get just because it's like scenes are just happening.
I would point out that this was written by the same writer as Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Oh, well, that guy doesn't have a great reputation.
Whose career was pretty much writing these kinds of 50s science fiction films.
But there's like, oh, man, it's like stuff like that makes me angry because there's so many good writers out there that aren't given a chance. And this dumbass just scribbles on a piece of paper and other bad writing like it. It gets turned into a film and it's like, why does it exist? Nobody wants it. Although you said this did all right then.
Yeah, this and Earth versus the Flying Saucers did actually good at the box office.
Boo!
And to this day, Earth versus the Flying Saucers is held up as one of the best alien invasion films.
What?
Of the 50s.
What? What?
I don't know. I've looked up like critics like I respect who do cover classic films, and it's like, why do you like this film? Especially when I find an old movie that I was like, oh man, I really dug that movie. I wonder what this critic has to say about it. And they're like, it was okay, whatever. And then I'm like, oh, I look up this and they're like, this was a solid film. And I'm just like, what the hell, dude?
Is that the same with this?
I didn't look up so many reviews of this. I don't think this is as highly regarded, if at all. The most I found about it was looking up stuff on Ray Harryhausen's career.
Ray Harryhausen.
Because that's what's of note here, is that this is his next movie after his breakthrough with The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Hmm.
He made that for Warner Brothers, and then he got brought on to Columbia and was immediately put on the B movie unit and made this and Earth vs. the Flying Saucers were the next two films he did. And then he was really itching to go to Europe. And so he was kind of like pitching a movie that was set in London. But they end up not making that. They are not producing that. He did some test footage. It was this weird idea he had about man-bat creatures in London. But that didn't go through. But they did take a script for a movie that was originally set in Chicago and decided to shoot it in Rome. So he got to go to Rome. And that's 20 Million Miles to Earth. So between The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and 20 Million Miles to Earth, that encapsulates a period of Ray Harryhausen's career that are his destruction films, where it was about destroying some city or a landmark with a giant monster or spaceships. And then he ended up closing out the decade by doing The Seven Voyages of Sinbad, which saw him enter into the next phase of his career, which was doing fantasy films.
Good for him, getting out of this stuff.
He got sick of destroying things. And I can see why, because it's just not that creative. And also, it was probably difficult, you know.
Incredibly tedious, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the budgets were so low, he couldn't get the equipment to do the destruction scenes the way he would want to, so he had to do them the hard way.
Frame by frame?
Frame by frame. So yeah, all the destruction scenes and in this and Earth versus the Flying Saucers, especially Earth versus the Flying Saucers with all those monuments just crumbling down. He's like, every single brick that was falling had to be put on a string and then moved frame by frame. It's impressive that he did the level of work he did. And when you're watching a movie like It Came From Beneath the Sea, what's alarming is the amount of artistry and craftsmanship and work that Harryhausen put in is in stark difference to the laziness of the rest of the film.
it's like Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
It's Earth versus the Flying Saucers all over again, exactly.
Like, it makes you feel bad for the guy, because he just puts so much work into something just so doesn't care.
Yeah, it's like, that's really frustrating. It's like, he's putting so much care and thought into this, and it's just like, the script is terrible. It's like, The actors are not to blame for how bad this film is. We've seen them in other stuff. I've run into the character who plays the lead a couple times. He's the lead in The Thing from Another World. Okay. And I was like, oh yeah. But he's so unremarkable that I don't recognize him, even though I've seen him multiple times. He just seems like a generic 1950s sort of leading man.
I wasn't, you know... Even if they've shown themselves to be competent in other films, I did not find any of the acting in this film good at all.
Oh, no. It was terrible. I mean, they're working with terrible material. It's like watch Natalie Portman in the Star Wars prequels and then watch her in anything else. It's like, oh, she can act. She just sounds awful and just comes off as terrible in these films. But yeah, the cringing lack of chemistry between the leads. It's just like, oh, don't you hate that when there's this forced romantic angle that shouldn't be there, doesn't deserve to be there, and it's so awkward. And like, we're watching Faith DeMorge, who I immediately recognized from a film noir I saw, Where Danger Lives, and I'm thinking to myself, A, don't trust her because she was a crazy bitch in that movie. She was schizophrenic and homicidal, and yeah. So it was just like, beware! But that wasn't the case in this film. But other than that, I was thinking, okay, the last guy I saw her in get entangled with was played by Robert Mitchum. And this guy is no Robert Mitchum. So yeah, it was just cringing to like, I could not be an actor. And
what are you talking about? You've earned your acting chops, Dave.
You've never directed me in a love scene. Just throw up in the back of your mouth a little there.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm usually just playing some weirdo or slacker.
Typecast.
Anything we've created. Yeah, yeah, really, really typecast here. But the one thing I do like to do is and get in front of the camera is I like to put on a costume and get in front of the camera.
Oh, yeah.
It's like if no one can see who I am, I'm totally gay. And then everyone knows it's me because of the way my body moves.
when you can assume a new persona, it's like you gain some of the confidence of that identity.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm just thinking of some of the shit we made in college, and I'm like, yeah, you became completely unself-conscious when you were playing those characters.
Yeah.
So acting is a very weird, out-of-body experience at times, because I did things where people looked at me later and were just like, how did you do that? And I'm like, it's what the character would do. The character would be fine with it. So I wasn't even thinking of it. It was me in this situation, you know?
Now, how do you turn that on in social situations?
Yeah, I've never developed that skill.
It's like, I don't care because it's not me. It's my character. But nobody cared, Dave.
Maybe
nobody
a little bit here. When I've had to cashier. Forced to smile and help people.
So how did this film open, Dave? Was it exciting for you?
No, I didn't know. It was like feeling unaware that the film had started. You know, it's just like there was a bunch of guys in a submarine just randomly pulling levers. And they kept pulling those levers. And I'm just like, what? I don't care. But like I said, it was just my attention span for this film was non-existent until Ray Harryhausen's octopus showed up. And it was a real stark difference where it was like I could not pay attention or care about anything the characters were saying or doing. And then all of a sudden, there's a stop motion octopus. You have my complete attention now.
Why did it start with like this submarine sequence that had no bearing on anything other than going like, we hear something down there, sir. And then like we hopped over to the scientists and stuff and there's just like nothing going on. And then at some point, like 30 minutes into the film, we get like a octopus attacking a boat. And it's like, you said, it's like, why isn't this the beginning of the film?
Exactly.
And you just carried it on from there. Because then it's like interrogating these sailors and trying to figure out what they experienced. And it goes on.
Which is how Godzilla starts. Godzilla starts with a ship blowing up. And you're like, you hear, you know, it's this guy's on a ship. And then there's this flash, and these guys go, what the hell is that? And then you hear this, and you see these guys screaming and running around the ship, and then the ship blows up. And you're like, what happened? And the next scene is they're picking up guys out of the ocean who are shaking and going, "Monster, monster, there's a monster," you know, and it's like, now you have me invested. You haven't shown me the monster, but it's like the Jaws effect, where it's like the beginning of Jaws when the girl goes swimming and you don't see the shark jump out of the water, but you see the terror that it can create and also murder.
I kind of want to re-edit this movie. I feel like you could do it.
I think you actually could probably cut out like half the film, so you'd end up with a half an hour film, but you could cut it down and rearrange scenes to actually make something that's more exciting. Because there was so much meandering BS that didn't need to be there. Again, it's one of those films, the budget is so low, they spend half of the movie just sitting around, you know, just putting the camera on actors. They didn't even go to fucking locations. Like, so much of this film was shot against rear projection. And it was astounding. They're doing the scene on a beach and they're not at the beach. They're shooting against a rear projection of just footage of a beach behind them. And I'm thinking, you made this in California and you didn't have the budget to go to a effing beach? I mean, to a certain extent, you're right. This film just feels really poorly edited, but then it's really poorly shot at the same time.
There's nothing exciting at all about the camera work, except for me, like, one shot. I'm like, oh, that's kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it just, nobody in this project, Dave, tried, except Ray Harryhausen.
And again, it's just an octopus, so it's, like, I mean, Ray Harryhausen got to work on Mighty Joe Young. That's an alright movie. The animation is really good. The plot is kind of just whatever. It feels like it should be better than it is. It's better than this. But the amount of character he was able to put into Mighty Joe Young, and while he was working under Willis O'Brien, they said that he did 85% of the movie. So it's like, yeah, he could put so much character into these things, but then he gets working in Hollywood and it's a giant lizard for Beasts from 20,000 Fathoms, and then it's spaceships and an octopus. And for me personally, it's not until 20 Million Miles to Earth that he's really creating characters, you know, in his films, which are his films, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, had that talent already, but he didn't really get to exercise it and create a creature that was a character until I believe it's called the Ymir in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. 20 Million Miles to Earth. Wow, it's really confusing that both of those have 20 in them. I love that creature. It steals the movie, and that's such a better movie than this or Earth versus the Flying Saucers or The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Like, of his science fiction films, that's probably the best one, and we're covering that next, so I'm really eager to get to it.
Oh, thank goodness.
Because I love that creature he created, and that movie's pretty good. The ending is what it is, but it's good.
I'll take your word for it, Dave. You better not be lying to me. You led me into a couple of these movies astray. Don't do it again.
Any movie that we covered on this that turned out to be a real stinker was a movie that I had not watched before. So there you go. Sorry.
It's not a good movie unless Dave's seen it.
Yeah, because any movie that I've seen that I know is not good, I don't want to watch again, so we don't review it. It's like, I'm not going to watch that again. It was bad. But if it's a movie, it's like, I've seen this. This is cool. We should cover this. That's when we cover the movie, you know?
Sure, Dave. Sure.
But let's talk about how this movie has a new breed of condescending asshole. It's kind of the most laughable point of the whole movie is they keep touting that the Faith DeMorge's character is this new woman, right? And some of the dialogue is just so atrociously, laughably sexist. It's not even offensive. It's just freaking funny. It's like a parody of, like, listen to these lines. It's like, do you mind if I make a mental comment upon the nature of women? It's like, who writes that dialogue? Seriously. Screw this screenwriter. And there's this whole dialogue where these two guys are talking about how her character is a new woman, like a new modern woman. And she's right there, not saying anything. She's literally standing between them, not contributing to this conversation about how she's allowed to take initiative and stuff. She's right there!
Yeah, when I realized that was what was happening, it was like, I...
Again, here's some dialogue. Look, Pete, you don't see many women in the seagoing Navy. Oh, shoreside women, sure. But there's a whole new breed who feel they're just as smart and just as courageous as men. And they are. They don't like to be overprotected. They don't like to have their initiative taken away from them. And she's standing right there! She could say this! But no, it's like the screenwriter was just like this troglodyte who is introduced to the idea of feminism and was just like, oh, I'll have to write a man explaining what this is. It's just so fucking stupid.
Oh, and she disappears at the end of the movie.
Yeah, the monster starts attacking the San Francisco Bridge and they're both running to do something about, because there's a guy, another character scientist for some reason drove out into the middle of the bridge. And he's like, hey, there's a monster here. It's like, how do we do that? There was some plot contrived reason why he was driving out there. He had to like throw some switch. Because apparently in the plot they wrote, there's some switch in the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge that he had to turn off. And so his car that he drives out there gets wrecked by a tentacle and they're like, oh no, he's going to get killed out there. And they're both running and then the guy stops, grabs the woman, shoves her into a police officer and yells at the police officer, keep her here. And then jumps into a car to save this guy. And we do not see the female lead of this film again until after the monster is destroyed. She's just non-existent in this. It's so bad.
Why?
This movie is unforgivable.
Like, that's like I think, you know, what episode? I already brought that up about a slew of 50s, like, TV and such that, like, would try to put in, like, this empowering message, but then yank it at the end.
Yes. Yeah, it's... What? Why? It's so weird if you look at the history of film. I'm not talking about the history of this country directly, but I'm talking about the history of film in that women are a big part of filmmaking in the silent era. And then sort of this transition happens where men take over the industry. But then you have some really prominent female stars who are not falling into the typical female roles, you know. And by the time you get to the 40s and the war years, they're promoting this idea of independent women in ways that hold up today, politically speaking. It's like there are some great films that are strong feminist films. And then it hits the 50s, and this wave of conservatism just takes over. I hate to call it, you know, the political group conservatives. It's like, you're responsible for this bullshit. But that's the only way I can describe it. This wave of trying to sort of put things back in their place and sort of create this, like, nuclear family. This is women's role. This is men's role. Just trying to create this very restrictive and exactly defined world. It's like that, and partially it was probably a reaction to the chaos of the Depression and the war years. It's really tragic how it ripped out the rug from underneath this strong feminist movement. For guys too, though, it was just like there was a very strict role that, that you were supposed to fall into. Mm-hmm. Of course, it didn't have the same impact. I'm not saying these are the same. I'm saying a similar thing happened, but it's no, by no means am I saying it's the same. But like you see, like guys from at this job, right? And it looks like the same guy in the same suit over and over and over again. You know, I mean, it's just terrifying to look at those pictures of what society became in the 50s. And I don't necessarily understand all the points of what made society that way for a brief moment. But the lasting effect, specifically on how it affected women and how they're portrayed in media and stuff, was unfortunate. And women in culture and business, it's like something was happening along a progressive line, and then it was just ripped away. You see it depicted in this film, and it's just like, okay, this was 55. How come I can go back to 1945 and see a film where they're not explaining new women? You know, they're just like depicting that character as a fully formed character. You know what I mean? Not this condescending bullshit. It's like, was the screenwriter just behind the times, or was this the times trying to pretend that that didn't happen? Like, were they actually trying to, like, say that that didn't happen? Right. That wave of progressive culture and filmmaking didn't happen? Like, trying to, like, destroy every image of Rosie the Riveter and pretend it didn't exist. That's what it felt like the 50s was trying to do.
It was actually Willis the Welder.
Yeah, sort of like when you hear, like, some states are trying to write textbooks to present something in a different way that completely skews what was like the actual history.
Yes.
And it's just, yeah, it's like that's what was going on. Like, why couldn't, when once you had Rosie the Riveter, once you had this new progressive movement, why couldn't that have kept going? Why was that rolled back so severely? And this is also like in the time in the 50s where like Christian fundamentalists come to rise, you know, sort of this extreme group of that are interpreting Christianity in this extreme way.
Still rippling around.
And that, I think that scares me, like looking at culture today, because like you see progress getting made in certain areas. But then something happens that changes the culture and that just rolls it all back.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing. Where for a couple decades, there's a bunch of progress, and then there's like a huge conservative backlash that puts the brakes on for another decade.
Yeah, and again, I want to specifically say that I'm using the term conservative as not... I'm not trying to attack the political group. But I'm trying to say forces that are resistant to change. It's like change was happening, positive change was happening, and then a force that was resistant to that took hold in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted to put basically everything in, pretend that everything fit into nice little boxes, that things weren't complicated, that this was just the way, it's like that it's black and white, and push that the culture promotes, that's like, this is what men are supposed to be, this is what women are supposed to be, this is what children are supposed to be, and enforce these social stereotypes and really attack those who don't fit into it. And what you have here really isn't, you know, it's mocking the idea of feminism. This film is actually, if you like, you read those lines like the new woman, it seems like it's actually trying to ridicule the whole feminist movement in its presentation of this character. It's just super disappointing. I mean, I'm not prepared to go into the complicated politics of this, but like that's how it came across to me. That it was the screenwriter put in all this to make fun of it. Is now how I'm in. It's the only way I can now interpret this. They keep referring to the new breed of women. It's almost like new breed is in quotes.
Hmm.
And I just don't understand why the screenwriter was such a fucking asshole.
Flying saucer female wasn't given much to do then either.
But at least they didn't mock her.
No.
For being her role.
I mean, that's very little consolation.
I mean, one of the things the feminist movement had to contend with is that all women are not the same in how they want to feel empowered either. And that's why there's various different, you know, you can find various different philosophies of feminism. Like I said, it's complicated. I'm not prepared to go into that right now. I'm here to talk about a stupid monster movie from the 50s.
Well, what else do you want to talk about with this stupid monster movie?
Well, you were bringing up it a little earlier in like how you could re-edit this movie to make this better. But it's like, the fact that this movie fails to work as a basic monster movie is astounding. It's like, not necessarily like, oh, how would you remake this to make this better? Like, yeah, you put something eventful happening at the beginning of the film. It's like, that's like basic screenwriting. It's like, that's nice. And like saying, like, how do you make this into a masterpiece? But like, how do you make this into a functional movie? Because this movie just fails to be a functional movie. First of all, you have to completely erase the characters that this film has presented you with because they're awful. They're just awful. But like we already said, you put a significant monster moment at the beginning of the film. Like you see the monster taking down a ship, and then you deal with like the sailors who survived that attack and people who believe them and people who don't. You know, you don't put that 20 minutes into the film. You put that at the beginning. It just seems so obvious, like, in the ways that this fails to be a basic monster movie.
I just want to try it.
I want to see if you can do it, too. It seems interesting.
It does. It's like with the Star Wars stuff.
You might want to use... we watched the colorized version, we should mention. You might want to use the black and white footage. Yeah,
I would use the black and white because the colorization of the background clearly made it look like a backdrop projection.
Yeah, it's more forgiving in black and white, I can imagine. It's less obvious how badly the backgrounds are made up. But, we didn't even mention that the octopus only has six legs because Ray Harryhausen was like, screw it, I don't need to animate it. Who'll know? Well, we all found out, Ray. I love Ray Harryhausen, and I'm so disappointed that we haven't gotten to any of his films that, like, actually thrilled us watching them. It's like, even Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, we're like, yeah, it's okay, it's a basic monster movie. But like,
we'll get there.
I want to get to the ones where you're actually like, wow, this is amazing. Like, obviously, Jason and the Argonauts is held up as his best film. And there's Clash of the Titans, which has some goofy stuff, but a lot of pretty cool stuff, too. There's a robot owl that I'm just like, that's in there. That's a robot owl. Like, the ending of this film just feels stupid. The beginning of it is one thing, where it's slow to get going. But then the ending of it, like, how do you fix that?
Yeah, the octopus just kind of gets in there and starts running amok, and then I don't know what the plan was the whole time until they blew it up with something.
Yeah, they shot a missile, a torpedo into it from a submarine, which got stupidly close to it.
It got grabbed, didn't it?
Yeah, it got grabbed.
Why? It's a torpedo. Why do you be that close?
Exactly. It's just... Screenwriter probably didn't bother to look up anything about actual submarine warfare.
It's like all these... every dang time in these monster movies, the helicopter or an airplane just got to be like right next to it.
I'm calling him out. George Worthing Yates. Bad screenwriter.
Mr. Yates, we condemn ye.
Oh, God, he also wrote Tormented with the dirty, stinking jazz
musician. Oh, really? He wrote that? Oh, dirty, stinking jazz. He had some problems.
Yeah, the guy has questionable moral character because he's a jazz musician. That is like a huge plot point of that movie.
Hates jazz. Hates women. What did he hate in Flying Saucer?
Foreigners?
Yeah, people just start fighting each other for the sake of it, right? Like the U.S., like the soldiers definitely like provoked the aliens into fighting, and then they're like, "Oh, we got to save ourselves."
We do have another one of his films coming up on the list.
Yeah, we might want to not.
No, but he didn't write it. He just came up with the idea.
Okay.
And it's a movie that I've seen, so I know it's good.
Okay, and it's, Dave.
It's Them.
Oh, okay.
It's like he apparently just came up with the idea of a giant ant movie. The rest of the screenplay was written by other people. He's not even like there's three screenwriting credits and he's the third one. So it just says story. It doesn't even say screenwriting. He just came up with the idea of giant ants.
Them, the ants from right over there.
But maybe he came up with the title.
I got a great idea for a movie. It's titled Them. Okay, what is it? Them. Run with it. Anywho.
There is a movie of his that he wrote that is apparently highly regarded. And it involves a detective finding out about the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln and trying to stop it. Called The Tall Target. That's a film that I do want to see. It's unfortunate that this a-hole wrote it.
Wah, wah, wah.
So yeah, okay, Lucas, you got a giant octopus movie.
Mm-hmm.
The giant octopus gets into the city and it's wrecking people, wrapping itself around buildings. What do you do to make that ending, the destruction of the monster, exciting? I mean, they were fighting it back on the ground level into the sea with guys with flamethrowers, and I thought that was pretty neat. I thought, like, you should have shown more of that. Like,
well, there's got to be something at stake.
Yeah, there has to be something at stake, something that matters besides just destroying the monster. Like, in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, the monster's blood carried a disease, so the more this monster just went around the city, people were getting sick. So they're like, right, we have to destroy this monster, and we have to do it in a way that contains its the disease in its blood. And they got Lee Van Cleef to shoot it with a radioactive bullet, which is pretty damn cool. It's unfortunate that they had to ride a roller coaster in hazmat suits to do it. Because that just made it look silly. But I still like felt invested in that ending, you know. So what's the thing that you do to make the giant octopus destroying the city extra dangerous? Like, and not just like we have to get this thing out of the city because it's a giant monster, but like what makes it imperative that it must be destroyed?
Well, why is it in the city?
Again, this film offers nothing on the terms of motivation.
Like, is it after something? Is there like a thing in the city? And like, if it got it, that'd be really bad, right? It's like, oh, the giant octopus is, you know, maybe the octopus, even if he is just running amok, he's headed for the nuclear power plant, and if he runs that thing over, we're all fucked.
Right, and then it becomes an act of diverging the path of destruction.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, everything we're doing is not working, and then something, I don't know.
And then they just drive it back into the sea.
Yeah.
Or the ocean, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, he's rampaging through, and then he hits, like, an oil storage place, sets a fire, and then it's like, oh, he's afraid of fire, you know? He's like, he's squealing away from it, and it's like, we got an idea how to get this thing out of the city. Instead, it was just like they're marching down with flamethrowers, and it's like, why didn't you try that already? It wasn't like, you know.
Yeah, it was just guys with flamethrowers showed up. Yeah. There was no reason for it. That no one said, Flamethrowers, that's what will work.
They just
kill it with fire.
Kill it with fire.
You know, it's like you don't see like ground level, like children screaming, like, ah, as this octopus is coming through the city, you know. Again, like Pacific Rim, that scene, that dream sequence is so effective. Like, you just see this little girl holding this adult woman's shoe. You understand that mommy's gone.
Why wasn't that the start of the movie?
Yeah, that should have been the start of that's Pacific Rim should have started with that. Again, Pacific Rim I like, but that movie could use some re-editing.
And character refocus.
Yeah. Then you see that. I think it's like this crab-like monster that's just coming down towards this little girl. And it's like, oh no, it has to stop. We have to save the little girl. Again, you feel like you need the audience to feel like something needs to be saved.
Yeah.
We need to care about something enough to mm-hmm. want to see it saved. That it matters to us. That makes it, when the giant robot comes in and punches the monster in the face, you're like, yeah! He saved the little girl. Whereas if you just have this monster ripping apart a city and then a monster punches it in the face, you're like, all right, mindless action.
And that's how you're introduced to those two characters. Instead of like, what was it before? It was just like the main character and his bro were just stomping around in their mech and they get attacked and then he clichely dies.
Yeah. It's like, I understand why it happens, but it's so telling. It's like when this release, when it's released into the world and like everyone notices the same problem.
Yep.
That it's like, why didn't the filmmakers notice that problem? Is it just like you're too close to it? You can't. Self-edit, that you can't see the problem yourself.
Mm-hmm. Can't see the forest through the trees.
Yeah, you can't see the forest for the trees. I can't see the forest, there's too many trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like you can't see the bigger perspective because you're focused on these little details.
Yep.
And as someone who writes stories, I'm... I'm paranoid about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, in the writing thing, it's like it's so easy in the writing part to just not notice unless you just stop and don't pick it up for a bit.
Yeah, it's like you need to, you know, walk away sometimes, come back to it the next day and be like, oh, I thought I was on right on target yesterday, but I missed something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've had that experience where I was just like, oh, I completely didn't think about this. And it's frustrating. But yeah, it's like, how do you make a good giant octopus movie?
Give it stakes.
Yeah, this probably is one of the best giant octopus movies ever made because it's just, what do you do with that concept? You know, it's like the Kraken's cool, not because it's just like this giant monster that rises up out of the sea and destroys ships, but because it's called upon by Zeus. It's like there's a character with motivation who's like, I'm going to destroy you with this freaky monster right now. And that's cool.
Release the Kraken!
That's become like this cultural thing that we all, Liam Neeson shouting, release the Kraken. You know, that sunk into the culture where people who haven't seen the movie know that, you know?
Well, Dave.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted this one. I certainly feel exhausted.
Said everything we can say about something.
It's a bad movie, Lucas.
Doesn't have much. Yeah, I gotcha. I agree. It was pretty early on that we decided that.
Yeah, it's like within 10 minutes of starting this movie, it's like we knew.
No. Oh, no. It was like when they got to the lab and they're just dithering around for another 15 minutes. Nothing's happening. All right.
That's a hell of a thing.
Well, Jellyheads, thanks for listening to this episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. We've been your host, Luke.
And Dave.
Thanks for tuning in. May I suggest you go to our website at cyclejellyfish.com to find this and other podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on any podcast app you prefer. And leave a comment if you got words about this film. Been a good one, folks.
Keep it psycho. So So there's a line of dialogue in this four up. I don't think it's a great line of dialogue in itself, but it's hilarious in the fact that in the script, the screenwriter is just putting in this line of dialogue to reveal that the movie's called It Came From Beneath the Sea because he's not creative enough to think up a name for it.
What?
All right. Commander Matthews, Doctor, what kind of a sea beast would be that large, and what do you call it so I can stop calling it it? And the doctor, Professor Carter goes, I have no idea. And Professor Joyce goes, nor have I. So, there's a line of dialogue in this film that exists just so the screenwriter can point out how fucking uncreative he is. Okay, I'm getting a little worked up over that.
You can't call it, like, a kraken or anything? There's a list of sea beastie names out there.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what was in the popular consciousness at the time. But there is just the severe lack of creativity in the name of this movie. It's one of the problems with, like, certain movie titles of certain eras. It's just like, what movie is that?
What is that movie?
Horror, I've found, is actually one of the better genres for, like, getting the names of the movies, right? Because it's usually just the name of the monster. It's like, oh, that's the movie with that monster in it, you know? But, like, these science fiction movies, they're so vague that, like, they want to keep it mysterious. So it's like, it came from beneath the sea. It came from outer space. The thing from another world. It, the terror from beyond space. You know, it's them. You know. So it's just like remembering the names of these movies. Also, film noir. It's like, wait a minute, why is the movie titled that? Film noir especially, that you could just have a random name generator. You just use, like, dark, street, night, you know, just, like, put in all these common words, you know, danger, you know.
Cranger.
Faith. DeMorgue, who's the lead actress in this, was in a movie called Where Danger Lives, and the guy was in a noir movie called Cry Danger. Both of our lead actors were in noir movies that had the word danger in the title. We should really start the podcast.